You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend. Tracy, at some point, we're going to have to do an oral history of the podcast and figure out how we landed on recording days also being Pathfinder days.
Yeah, it probably involves me needing to skip a weekend because of a work thing or a something, and that throwing us into some weird off-schedule parallel that we've never gotten off of, and now we're just cursed.
Yeah, because today is Pathfinder Day. So I did all my preparation for my Pathfinder game last night because I knew I wouldn't have time today.
Yeah.
And since my players can't listen or can't hear this because they're going to be playing this afternoon, like they won't know any spoilers, I'm going to pull the rug out from underneath them in a really, really hard way.
Oh, see, this is the advantage of the podcasting time warp.
Timey-wimey. Yeah. Timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's going to be fun. Not as much fun as our interview today, but still fun.
That is true. So we're super lucky to have Jakub Szmalek on with us. And you may not know Jakub's name just to hear it, but chances are very good that you're familiar with some of his work in video games, narrative design and writing. But we're here to talk about Inner Space, which is your just recently released book. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Feels deeply timely in a both highly fortunate and also kind of uncomfortable way. So I don't want to get in front of you talking about Inner Space for yourself. So do you want to catch the listeners up on what the premise of the novel is?
Absolutely, yeah. So Inner Space is a tech thriller set aboard the ISS. That's the International Space Station. And I guess the reason why I was drawn to this particular, you know, piece of space tech flying in orbit is because to me, the ISS is a symbol of a certain optimistic time in our recent history that sadly seems to have expired as of late. It is kind of an embodiment of this hope that people from all walks of life and different countries and different worldviews can come together and work for the betterment of humankind, you know, kind of a Star Trek-y vision of humanity.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, geopolitics have caught up with us. And now we have, you know, Russians, Europeans and Americans sharing and Japanese and a few other nations, but international community sharing this space. And obviously there's a lot of tensions. And I was intrigued to explore and imagine how these tensions transfer to the ISS and what it must be like to live and cooperate in such a tight space with all that going in the background. So yeah, that's, I guess, my initial summary of what it is about.
And it's, I think, the idea of a crisis on Earth, in this case, the crisis of Ukraine being invaded by Russia, playing out down the well, so to speak, from the ISS. And at the same time as the ISS itself is navigating its own technical crisis that threatens the well-being of the astronauts there's this sense that what's operating in the ISS is like this kind of microcosm of the same hostilities and mistrust and biases that are driving what's happening down on Earth. And I think in some respects, the ISS is a valuable setting, not just because there's this sort of unfortunate loss of this Star Trekian Roddenberryan vision, right? Roddenberryan vision, but also the idea that, like, because you can't leave easily, you are all there together. There is no space from which to easily separate yourself from these sorts of tensions. They have to be confronted differently, both because of proximity and survival and all these sorts of other factors. And I'm really kind of interested in how that influenced some of your thinking about how the narrative could possibly play out.
Yeah, I guess that was my starting point, really. So the story goes like this. I have a daughter. Her name is Matilda. And she had this phase in her life where she was absolutely and totally fascinated by space. exploration of space, planets, stars, you know, the whole shebang. She has since moved on to sharks, which is, you know, another amazing topic. Of course, I mean, it's
what is the sea but the space that's below us?
Yeah. Exactly, and it's full of sharks. So why wouldn't you become totally obsessed with that? But that was still during her space phase, and it was really interesting to me because, you know, as her dad, I would try to encourage her and kind of help her explore that. So I would start reading more about space. And kind of start looking up to the night sky again and kind of notice the stars and all that, because I feel, at least in my case, when you're so busy with the, you know, the pros of life and the daily grind, you kind of let all that fade into the background. Mm-hmm. And I'm endlessly fascinated by how much we are able to kind of push into the background and how quickly we get used to things. But that's another kind of topic. So anyway, we took Matilda to the Space Museum in Toulouse in France, and it's an amazing place. If you ever have a chance to visit, do go. And they have a full-size replica of the Mir space station, so the old Russian space station. You can actually walk into it. We can walk inside and kind of feel what it's like to be inside. And I'm not claustrophobic at all, and I immediately felt like the walls pushing in. Felt like, you know, the trash compactor scene from Star Wars, like the moment you step in, because everything is so narrow. And because cosmonauts, in this case, would function in like minimal gravity environment. So there's no up and down. So like each of the surfaces is just bristling with cables and buttons, and there's lots of edges, and you have to be very mindful of where you are. And it struck me that, you know, people seem so excited about going into space, and then they end up in a space like this, you know, where you constantly have to draw your elbows in, and there's nowhere to run, and you're so far from anything that seems welcoming and friendly in terms of, like, you know, spaces. And then I thought, okay, and now we have people up there who have very good reasons to, like, be wary of one another, you know, when you think about what's going on between Russia and America and Europe. Down here, there's no way it doesn't translate into some tension up there. And we before going on air, we talked about working and remotely versus working from home, and how working in an office, even with the people you love, you know, it gets to you after a while, and thank God we all get to go home. But these people, they don't. They're, you know, up there in this space for months at a time, and they have to be so close to one another. So, like the minute I walked out of that replica, I was like, oh my God, this is such an amazing set piece for a claustrophobic intimate thriller where people are in their heads and they have nowhere to hide, nowhere to run, and the tensions just fill up the space. So that was my starting point. It was an amazing adventure, and there was so much research that I had to do. And I really regretted not paying more attention during my physics classes in high school, because that would have made it much easier. I had a lot of catching up, but it was a fascinating trip. And I hope that some of that, you know, nerdy fascination with space, with physics and with stars kind of translates into the book, and readers get to, you know, go on this ride with me.
You know, as you were saying that, it was reminding me of two different things. One was, we had a guest, Tracy, whose name escapes me, mm-hmm. who had been to Antarctica.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And they do so much, like, psychological testing, and they try it, because you're going to be stuck there in this closed environment with other people.
Like,
so they want to make sure that the people who go there are going to get along. And are going to be okay with the isolation and all the stuff, right? So that reminded me of that. The other thing is, have you ever seen, there's an Apple TV show called For All Mankind?
Yes, of course.
And the only way to, quote unquote, get away from anybody is to put on a spacesuit and walk out on the surface of the moon. Mm-hmm. And they had the character, I forget, it's like the best friend character. He was starting to lose it. And mm-hmm. so the only, like, he just kept going for walks because it was just driving him nuts.
Yeah.
And so he would just go out and just sit on the surface mm-hmm. of the moon, staring up into the blackness of space. And, like, I don't think that was healthy. That's what he did.
Probably a cry for help. Also, on the ISS, it wouldn't be as easy to just go on a walk. It's hours of preparation. It's all scheduled years ahead. And the moment they walk out of the hatch, they have a shopping list of things they need to do minute by minute. And it's apparently really hard, like on your body, and also one of the riskiest things you can do out there. And apparently, like one of the risks that they run is drowning, which surprised me. But the closest, the astronauts on the ISS came to a tragic accident while in a spacewalk recently was when an Italian astronaut had a leak in the little straw that brought water from his water pack into his helmet, and it started leaking water, and water was filling his helmet. And minimal gravity environment, the water is slushing around, getting in his nose, in front of his eyes. And what is he gonna do? He won't take off the helmet to shake it up. He had to make his way back to the station, and that's really hard to do on a good day. And when you have water droplets dancing in front of your face, it gets really, really scary real fast. So yeah, I don't think even walks are a part, are a part of the picture for the poor astronauts on the ISS. Yeah, I would absolutely go crazy very, very quickly. And funnily enough, one of the amazing discoveries for me when I was working on this book was the labyrinth that is the NASA website. It's such a wonderful mess, because there are dead websites which aren't linked to anywhere, but you can sort of find your way to them, and they have all sorts of articles and links and pictures out there, and some of the links are dead but some are not, or you can time machine them and find stuff. And I found a study where astronauts were anonymously responding about their psychological health, and it seems they're not immune to this. It's not they're superhumans who just are happy all the time. And being in space is actually really taxing on the psyche as well. But yeah, tests are a big thing, and I also found it really intriguing and kind of funny that different space agencies have different ways of testing their candidates. And the Japanese, and this is true, have them fold origami for hours, and then they check if the first origami kind of figurine is as detailed and as meticulously done as the last one, because that's what you want in your astronaut, someone who pays attention to the details, from the start till the very end. Whereas the Canadians, of course, drop their prospective astronauts into the tundra and see how they do, with all the black flies and other, elements of that environment. So yeah, oh my god, start reading about space, it's a bottomless rabbit hole, and there are so many fascinating stories.
When I hear the kinds of stories that you're telling there, Jakob, I think a lot about various billionaires and apparently on the road to becoming a trillionaire, have talked about that the next frontier for the human species is to go and colonize Mars, to go live off world. And that's as much as I am a great lover of science fiction, it's always been something I'm deeply skeptical of, partly because of the psychological elements we've been talking about here, but also because of the realities that you were talking about back to the Space Museum in Toulouse. The idea that the kind of Ray Bradburyan vision that they're having of we're going to kind of create a sort of a pleasant megalopolis of some sort on the surface of Mars, and we will go and live there and all will be well, and somehow this can be realizable in a meaningful and small number of human lifetimes. All of that flies in the face of what we know through science and engineering and rigorous, dedicated experimentation to be true about what it is both to get to space and to survive there, and that it is effectively how can you survive being in a vacuum bottle for X period of time, and how well can you function for yourself or others. And because of that, I think I've never been especially concerned about the kind of billionaire oligarch drumbeat to go off world, because the reality is, even if somehow they got what they wanted, they're not going to get what they actually want. It would never be something that someone would want. But the real concern, I think, has to do with, if you focus so much on let's live off world, what do you decide you can afford to not focus on in our own world? Like that, mm-hmm. that now this world becomes secondary. And I think in some ways that takes us back to that idea of the conflict that is happening on Earth. And to some degrees, I think, you know, very, very much in the world that we're living in right now, like, are we using the promise of going out beyond our planet as an excuse to just kind of not try very hard here?
Yeah. Oh my God. So many fascinating issues that you brought up here. Unfortunately, it seems like you can't really leave politics out of space, and you can't not put it in your kind of carry-on. It's always going to be your stowaway passenger. Mm-hmm. One of the questions that comes again and again is like, why do we do it? Like, what is the pragmatic root cause reason for us to go into space? And the reason for us to go into space is to go into space. Like, there is nothing to be gained, at least not in the immediate time frame that we all live in.
I know what the reason is.
Okay. What is it?
To explore strange new worlds. Seek out new life and new civilizations.
Yeah.
To boldly go where no one has gone before.
We can do it perfectly well without sending humans out of space. Actually, humans may make terrible space explorers, because we need to eat, we need to poop, we need to shower, we need to have all these things for our psychological comfort. Turns out, you don't feed people good food, they're going to go crazy very, very quickly.
No, we're very squishy.
Yeah, we're very squishy and very fragile. Like, even, you know, the ex-military guys that, you know, did the Mercury and Apollo missions, initially NASA would pack them with, like, scientific, you know, 50s, 60s weird sciencey food, like, you know, little cubes of meat and whatever. And, like, these men absolutely hated it, and it would drive them crazy to the point that they tried smuggling, like, normal bread onto their capsules, which then caused problems because they had crumbs.
The air recyclers are just full of rats.
Yeah, all of gunk and that stuff grows on it. So, like, humans in space, it's like, we can't go very far. And when we do, we are definitely less versatile than the little, you know, rovers that can go on forever and they don't complain. So, like, we don't really need humans in space, but we do want to send them out there. And I think it's, you know, on the one hand, it's beautiful to me. We can still be, idealists who just follow a dream and we do something beautiful, even though there's no immediate payback. And, you know, in our capitalist world, that's such a rare thing. But on the other hand, as you say, by spending money on that, we are taking resources from other possibly more pressing needs. And I don't remember which movie it was. I think it might have been The First Man with Neil Gosling. There was a striking scene where you see the rocket about to fly into space, and the African American protesters were protesting the flights because they very rightly, you know, we're trying to bring attention to their plight and the fact that, they were in desperate need of help, and yet money was divested somewhere else. And yeah, I don't have a good answer to it, of course. And that's what, you know, one of the beauties of being a writer, no one really cares what you think. So you can, write whatever.
Until you write a Star Wars book, and then they care what you think.
Oh yes, yes. But that's like self-inflicted. that's only for people who like living close to the edge. So something draws us to the to the stars, and it's beautiful that it does. But I'm not sure that we are, you know, heeding to this call in the right way. And especially when it comes to, you know, all these fantastic, you know, billionaires and trillionaires who I'd be very happy for them to move to Mars permanently and just have their own, like, you know, happy place there. I feel like the energy they bring to this whole endeavor makes me think that we won't have a Star Trek future anytime soon, unfortunately. It looks like more of a, you know, Ayn Rand kind of a science fiction short story, which I'm not too thrilled to follow.
Yeah, I hadn't wanted to be part of central casting for that.
No, please don't.
So this is a bit of a swerve, but I find the question compelling, and it actually comes to me out of reading from Inner Space and then sort of comparing what I was reading against the blurb at BAC. And one of the blurbs at BAC, which is very interesting to me, talks about you as an author having an understanding of the Russian mentality and its workings.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that interesting in two directions. The direction first that it presupposes that there is such a thing that is identifiable as a Russian mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And as a thoroughbred American, I can't claim to have any knowledge of what that would be. But if we were to turn that around, considering that the primary conflict in the novel is between an American astronaut and her compatriots and their Russian counterparts on ISS, and how are they sort of coping with the crisis that they need to manage together and figure out what caused it. It sort of presupposes as well that there would be an American mentality. And then I sat back and said to myself, okay, I'm the wrong person to answer this question. But you have the benefit of a perspective that has given you proximity to both of these worlds. And so
indeed, yes.
I am really interested in this question of a national mentality.
I feel like we could talk for hours just about that because, you know, identity is such an interesting concept and it seems so important to us because, you know, when someone asks you, who are you? You come up with identities, these abstract things, you know, I'm this and that, I'm American, I'm Canadian, I'm Polish, whatever. And yet we all wear different hats and some of these hats are put upon us and some we wear willingly. So yeah, I feel we could explore this space for a long time, but let me try to gather my thoughts and give you like a succinct answer to this very, very cool question. So I'm originally Polish. I was born in Poland. I spent most of my life there, but I also studied in the UK on an American scholarship. I live in Canada now. So I do think that I kind of experienced different environments and like I lived for part of my life in the part of the world that's closer to the Russian sphere of influence. And I also live now right across the American border. I think one thing about living in Eastern Europe is that you're constantly afraid. You're constantly afraid of war, very rightly so, because that has been like our experience generation after generation. And also, I would say that we were always like living back in Poland. We were always very keenly aware. That Russians are hard to befriend, and that their view of the world doesn't necessarily hinge on being friends with their neighbors. Yeah, it's hard to say, you know, is this, because I don't want to also, you know, say something about, you know, all the Russians out there, because I'm sure there are fantastic Russian people who are terrified about what's going on. But I would say that there is something about the worldview that kind of Russian elites, Russian establishment presents that you would find a little bit alien in terms of values or in terms of like the understanding of how the world works. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the biggest difference, I think, although, you know, things are changing now and maybe my perception of, you know, the US is also, evolving as the geopolitical scene is evolving.
Same.
In lockstep. but I would say that, when I think about, you know, the Russian worldview, it's built upon distrust. It's like, you can't trust anyone. Because everyone is out there to get you. And historically, I think there are, you know, very good reasons for seeing the world as such. Because that has been the experience for people in Eastern Europe for so many generations. And I could go on again for why, but I think, you know, communism, feudalism, and a few other isms rolled together give you just that. And I think, and that's my, that's been my experience living in Northern America, that I think there's a lot of, a lot is built on community, sense of community, it's a sense of belonging and connecting with other people. And this can go, you know, this can go awry, of course, too, because if you're starting thinking of in-groups, out-groups, and excluding people and defining yourself as opposed to some other people, this can lead to all sorts of problems. But I feel like that need to connect and to have close bonds with people is very very present. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure if I managed to.
I think you're doing
collect my thoughts, but I was trying my best.
I think you're doing as well with it as anyone could possibly do. And I don't think, I'm not exaggerating my own point of view here. And Patrick, you'll have to speak for yourself. But as a person living in America in a disrupted and transformational time, I feel a little bit as if without the physical claustrophobia of a space like Mir or ISS, but I feel a little bit as if I too am trapped in a space with people who I'm not sure I understand anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I can make assumptions about common needs and desires about anymore. And that is, if there's anything that I think has been characteristic of my experience of being an American, it has been a certain degree of unearned feelings of security. There have been wars in my lifetime, but they have always been away. They've always been sort of elsewhere. And we have had people who have fought in them and sacrificed in them, but they've never been about our soil or our territory. Arguably, they've been about other things that we tried to turn into an our thing later. But in many ways, I think there's a sense, for me, of having been an American, of just my life is generally something that I can count on being secure from day to day. I will have my problems. I will have my struggles. But I'm never going to sort of worry about the world as I understand it being toppled. And I think that there has been a kind of trajectory over the last 10 years or so that has very much undermined that.
Yeah, it's scary. I think I can totally relate to that. And I grew up in the 90s. And that was like a blip in Eastern European history when things seemed to be going well, because Soviet Union has collapsed. We joined the EU and NATO, and year to year, all the green arrows were, you know, going, climbing upwards. And we, I think we were all kind of thinking along the lines of Francis Fukuyama, who announced the end of history, and we all applauded because, you know, history sucks. I mean, it's a very interesting, interesting topic, but. Most of it is really depressing. So I'd be glad for history to end and we could all, you know, sing Kumbaya together. And it really seemed like maybe we are slowly working to get there. And I don't have that optimism anymore. And of course, as you say, it's hard to say what's fixed anymore, right? You know, we had some paradigms that seemed to be very firmly in place, and now it seems like we are finding out where we are week to week, and it's like some sort of a weird tangled quantum universe where things just can flip instantly before your eyes.
Yeah, what happened was we and Tracy and I talk about this sometimes in our Patreon only episode, which you can get if you go to patreon.com/functionalnerds and become one of our backers. But like sometimes we'll talk about it there. But essentially, the things that we thought were solid turns out aren't. And there are I'm going to just talk about America for a second. Like, I'm not talking about the wider world. In America, we thought that, well, there's rules, there's laws, there's things that are in place. And those things are, again, are solid. And what it turns out is they're only as solid as the people in power allow them to be.
Yeah.
And if they choose to ignore the rules or ignore the laws and say, well, that doesn't apply to me, then it all falls apart. And that's where we're at now, because it's like you have a subset of Americans who are going, but here's the rules. Why aren't you following the rules? And then you have another subset of Americans going, but those don't apply to me. And like the rules as we interpret them are this, but that's not. And so then you just get this clash that goes back and forth, and you have the folks who are in power and the folks who aren't in power, and the folks who aren't in power are going, but it needs to be like this, but it needs to, and they're not changing as these things are shifting. And so that's the big problem, is that like if let's say that you have a federal judge who issues a subpoena to someone, and that someone goes, no, you don't have any power over me, and just ignores it. And then that person is also the person in charge of enforcing the subpoena from a federal standpoint. Then the subpoena has no power. The judge has no power. The law has no power. That's the reality that we're living in America right now.
It's a little startling to realize that much of what this particular civilization has hinged on is functionally a gentleman's agreement.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. This is all really fascinating. Makes me think of Yuval Noah Harari, the Israeli writer, who made a very convincing case. I think that what defines our civilization is shared myths and shared stories, and how like a lot of our reality is really hinges on our agreement on some abstract concepts like money or law. That like ultimately, what is law? Law is words on paper, and paper is very easily torn. And the real underpinning of power is brute force. It's the power to hit someone else on the head and to get away with it. And it is a really harsh awakening to realize that this is what it boils down to. And I lived through that in Poland. One of the reasons why I live in Canada is because we experienced exactly that kind of process just a few years ahead of you guys. We were ahead of the curve for once. and we just saw laws being ignored and trampled and realizing there's very little one can do. Which isn't a sunny conclusion. I feel like we are creating a bit of a downer here.
Fortunately.
We have a cure for that. We have a cure.
Okay.
The cure for that is always the picks of the week.
Oh, fantastic.
We'll get to picks of the week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, picks of the week.
All right. So, Patrick, can you help make things sunny?
I can. So, as mentioned earlier, I'm a fan of the Pathfinder role-playing game. And every other weekend, I run a Pathfinder game for my friends. And then on the opposite weekend, one of those players runs a 5e campaign for a different group of friends that I'm part of. So I love role-playing games. And longtime listeners know that I'm also a huge fan of the beginner's box, the starter box. You know, these tend to be based on the classic Dungeons & Dragons red box kind of thing. And Pathfinder is doing something new that I like. And it's called Deluxe Adventures. And these are like little mini starter packs. And what it is you have everything you need in one box to play a campaign, like a quick little one night game night kind of thing. So if you have some friends and you want to invite them over and play a game and you want to kind of introduce them to Pathfinder, but they're not interested in a long campaign or doing like a bunch of stuff and rolling characters and all this and that. You pull out one of these deluxe adventures, and I happen to have one here. It's called it's Pathfinder Game Night, and it's called Dawn of the Frogs.
Okay.
And this is just a little, it's a little thin box, and it comes with 36-page adventure booklet with three different adventures. So it's kind of replayable, right? You can do one on one night, and then if someone likes it, you can do a different one on another night.
Dawn of the Frogs, Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah, it's got it's got pre-generated character sheets in it. So you just like, hey, who wants to be the fighter? Who wants to be the wizard? Who wants to be the cleric kind of thing? It's got maps. So all your locations are there, and it comes with minis,
nice,
and rules essentially for running the game, and it just it's a real quick little thing. I'm showing you guys like the pictures.
Yeah, it's a genuine starter pack.
But it's just like a little starter pack, and it's just it's game night. I mean, it's literally it says game night on there. And this is just something where if you want to get your friends, maybe they don't do TTRPGs, they've never done D&D, but they do board games. Like, you could just break this out, hand them a character sheet, and you just grab your dice and you play. And there's no commitment. There's no pressure. It's just a fun little game night thing. And I like this. And they're doing more of these. So that's my pick tonight, today. Pathfinder Game Night, Dawn of the Frogs by Jason Bowman. And I'm sure that I mispronounced his name. So, Jason, I do apologize to you. But this is pretty cool. I like it. And you can get it at paizo.com.
Nice. Nice. Well, that's a good start here. We're on a roll now. So, Jakob, how about you?
I'm going to go with Naked Gun, the movie, the new
nice.
One with Liam Neeson. And we talked about some dark stuff before, so this is a nice, I think, counterweight. Because it's such a silly movie that's genuinely doing its hardest to make you laugh. And I don't know about you, but it's been a while since I've been to a cinema to watch a movie that's just trying to do that. And it's not a tongue-in-cheek kind of fourth wall-breaking wink, wink, nudge, nudge, kind of a humor, but like someone is trying to tell you a joke and taking the risk of it not landing and like, you know, really committing to it. And I just had a magnificent time and left until my belly ached. And I will, in sad moments, I will recall Pamela Anderson beatboxing a jazz concerto with a straight face, because it's just, you know, such a beautiful scene. So if you haven't seen The Naked Gun yet, I think it's a good idea to give it a go.
And can I just throw out there, like, of all the things that could have survived for 30 plus years, 40 almost, right?
Yeah.
A short-lived television show called Police Squad that becomes, 20 some odd years later, Naked Gun, the movie, and then Naked Gun 2.5, I think, was the second one.
Yeah.
And then to continue 33 on. 33 and a third. Yeah. And then to continue on and do like a reboot, like of all the things, and just be so silly. And so I'm 100% on board with that. That's a great pick.
Your pick there, Jakob, gave me an idea. So when we do the opening in the future, and I'm doing the thumbs up or thumbs down to tell you whether or not the music cued through, or if you're going to have to, worry about it in post or anything like that. If it fails in the future and I have to give the Emperor's thumb down, I'll just beatbox the intro. I'll go full Pamela Anderson for you there.
It'll be fun.
See, I thought you were going to do the sight gag, which doesn't work well on audio.
No.
The TV show used to end, because all the police procedural shows would end like on a freeze frame.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they were making fun of those on the TV show, the actors would just go.
Yeah.
And then you'd see them like swaying as they're like, they can't hold it as the credits are rolling. Yeah. And like someone would walk behind them and then realize what was going on and freeze. It was hilarious.
Yeah. All right. So a little bit of a swerve here. My pick is a book. And it wouldn't sound like something that is sunny in nature, but it is just genuinely a delight to read, and I highly recommend it. The book itself is not new, but this translation of it for readers in English is new. So the book is The Man Who Died Seven Times by Yasuhiko Nishizawa. Yasuhiko Nishizawa. I completely massacred that. I'm so sorry. But The Man Who Died Seven Times, as you might guess, is a murder mystery, but it's a time loop based murder mystery where in the celebration of New Year, This family has gathered and to discover that their grandfather has been murdered. And in the course of the family gathering to celebrate New Year, we end up following the point of view of the 16-year-old grandson, who ends up getting stuck in this time loop where he repeats the same day, beginning to end, over and over again, and figures out that the key to unlocking being trapped in this day might be figuring out who killed Grandpa. Whether or not it will also involve saving Grandpa remains to be seen as the story plays out. I haven't finished it yet, as you might guess from the way that I'm talking about it. But there's a wonderful kind of earnest rolling eyes at the universe, exhausted at the universe, that only a 16-year-old can do straight-faced narration that we get out of here, that I give a lot of credit to Jesse Kirkwood, the translator, for being able to pick up on. So it's been published by Pershkin Vertigo, here in the United States. The translation is brand new for this year, but the original came out in Japanese in 2017. So if that sounds like you're kind of weird and diverting, I would highly recommend it.
Nice.
All right. So we've been on many journeys here, from the recommendations to up to the ISS and back again. Thanks so much for being with us, Jakob. I would love it if you could tell our listeners where to find your next cool projects, what's coming up, and how they can continue to support your work.
Sure. So as you mentioned early on, books aren't my only thing. I also write for video games. So I worked on The Witcher 3 and Cyberpunk 2077 and a few others.
Nerd.
But I'm currently working on this amazing game that's going to come out next year. It's called The Blood of Dawnwalker. So that's where you can find more of my work if you'd like to take a gander.
I just want to throw out Cyberpunk 2077. That was one of those where my video game friend group, we all jumped on that immediately. Like that was the one we were all waiting for. And my friend Giles has done like 4 playthroughs at this point because he's just ridiculous.
No, I give a tremendous amount of credit actually to Cyberpunk 2077 because I teach speculative fiction classes at the boarding school where I work. And if like 4 years ago, when I got to the unit where I talked to my students about Cyberpunk, they would just stare at me. Mm-hmm. They had no idea what I was talking about. It was very done for them at that point. Mm-hmm. Like as a piece of terminology, it had no resonance for them. If I started pulling up examples of stuff, it kind of did. But I think, you know, we have to reset our expectations here a little bit. Like The Matrix came out in 1999.
Yes.
I'm teaching at a high school.
It's a classic. Yes.
Right. Also yeah. Classic. I'm teaching at a high school. This The Matrix is older than their older siblings when I'm teaching these like 16 and 17 year olds. And so the idea of being like, yeah, this hot new thing with bullet time, they're like, what? And so I give Cyberpunk 2077 tremendous credit for re-injecting that whole kind of very like economically and sociologically and aesthetically complicated sort of like ethos into the conversation, because now when I talk to my students about Cyberpunk, they're like, I know what that is. Mm-hmm. That's a video game. And I'm like, kids, it's a lot more than that.
Yes, it's complicated, but also that. Yeah, oh my God, it's a genre that is definitely has a lot to say about our current circumstances and addresses some of our fears and hopes. So I hope that with that game we kind of resuscitated the whole thing a little bit, because I think the world needs more cyberpunk.
There is a TTRPG based on cyberpunk.
Of course. Well, that's that was a starting point, of course.
That goes all the way back to me being in middle school, probably well before then too, actually. But
no, I mean there's one based specifically on the video game.
On the 2077.
Yes, on the 2077.
Okay, yeah. So I was.
I don't know. Is it Command Games or Modiphius? One of those is doing.
Yeah, back when I was playing Cyberpunk as a TTRPG, it was called Cyberpunk 2020, which now seems quaint.
And I remember you could get a bionic arm with a cassette player. So
because you're super cool, like Johnny Silverhand.
You could put a cassette in your arm and listen to music as you went about your business.
Be kind.
The bleeding edge of technology, the boombox arm. Thank you so much for being
you're
with us, Jakob.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it.
If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.